Okay, and yeah, I put, so these files are on the web pages, and if something doesn't work with them as you expect, please let me know. And I think it actually makes a reasonably understandable audio file, at least when I tried it in the past. Okay, good. So what we've been doing is we've been looking at a number of theorems which have to do with how can you, if you have sets and you want to spread them out in some bigger set, how can you do this, for example, with intersection? If you have a room and you want to, you might be able to place 5 pianos but not 7, even though by total area the pianos would fit. It's the same idea. At some point the sets just need to intersect. And there is one more theorem of this type, which I want to prove. And this is a reasonably famous theorem, and is actually, there are other theorems in that category, in that class, which are called, well, let me first say, so this theorem is due to Erdős, Kuh, and Grado. So these are three people. The first time I heard about it, I thought, oh, there was an Erdős-Rado theorem, and then there is the Erdős-Kuh-Rado theorem. That's when you revert the order of the maps or so, but that's not the case. This is a person. It's similar flavor, but yeah. Anyhow. And that theorem is from 1961.
Jeez.
And yeah, so this is a theorem for sets. There are similar theorems for other structures of objects. Indeed, there is about 3-4 years ago, a book was published which is basically called Erdős-Kuh-Rado Theorems, which uses this as a theme to look at the situation. Anyhow, so let me first flip to the page where I actually want to be. So what does this theorem say? Let script A be a collection of subsets, A1 up to AM. These are all subsets. AI, they should be different, and they are subsets of some bigger set, which I call big N, which is the set of numbers 1 to little n. And we want to have all of them to have k elements. Right, and I want k to be smaller or equal than n over 2. Right, and what I want is that not just are they not equal, but I want that any two of them have empty intersections. Sorry, that any two have, oh, sorry, but any two have non-empty intersection. Yeah. It's not the empty set. And what this is now saying is you can't do this with arbitrarily many sets. So in this case, and that's the conclusion of the theorem, M is bounded by N minus 1, choose K minus 1. Okay. Right. That's what I want to prove. And as a tool for this, I will look at particular subsets. So let Fi be the set of numbers I plus 1, and so forth up to I plus K minus 1. So these are particular K element subsets. And I take set script F be the set of those elements Fi, of those collections Fi. And I count this basically like a modulo arithmetic, so minus n if greater than n. Or sorry, I just, if I write it modulo, I need to take, the formula gets messy, I need to take a minus 1 modulo n minus 1 plus 1, because modulo moves to 0 and I want to move to 1. So I just want to consider this cyclically. So I have 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, 5, and at some point I have, say I have 16 elements in total, I will have 14, 15, 16, the next one is 15, 16, 1. So that's what I mean by this notation. Okay. Right. What I claim is that in this case, if I intersect my set collection I start with this set collection, I get at most k elements. Okay. Why is this the case?
Can you say that the cardinality of that intersection is?
Oh, yeah. The cardinality of that intersection. Yes, thank you. I should put this cardinality of that intersection. So, let's suppose, why is this the case? Suppose I have sum Fi equals sum Aj. Okay. I have that any two of these A sets intersect non-trivially. Right? So, if one of these sets Fi is equal to one of the A's, any other FL, which is also an A, must intersect this Fi. So, then any other FL in F intersection script A must intersect Fi. Right? Again, why is this the case? If Fi and FL are both in F intersection A, they are both in A, and being in A, they intersect non-trivially. So, then this FL must intersect Fi. But these F sets are very clearly described. If Fi is in there and I have another FL, what is the choice for L? That means that I minus K plus 1 is smaller or equal than L, is smaller or equal than I plus K minus 1. And this again taken with this going around or modulo. Because these are of length K, right? If I have two sets of K subsequent numbers and they intersect non-trivially, this one can't start more than K after and can't begin more than K before. So, so that means, and furthermore, I have that, so that tells me about the index here. Once I have one, I can be at most range k forward or k past. But if I have two sets f in f, which are at distance k, they do not intersect. So I can't go backwards and forwards.
But f x intersection f x plus k is the empty set.
That means I have at most k elements in a subsequent range, k indices in a subsequent range that can be in script A. Okay. Right. Well, that holds for an arbitrary set script A, right? Which satisfies these conditions. So, the same holds, therefore, if I permute the and relabel the entries in the AIs. Okay? And instead of relabeling the entries in the AIs, I could relabel the entries in the Fs. I just relabel them with the inverse permutation. That's the same whether I do it here or there, just the labeling is different. So, this holds after arbitrary relabeling of the entries in the AI, and therefore also after relabeling of the entries of the Fs. So, what do I mean by this? I mean that, and let's give it a name, this value I will call it Z, that shall be the sum over all permutations of n points, size of the intersection of A intersected script F acted on by pi. And what shall this be? This shall be F was the set of the Fi's, and so this is the set of the Fi to the pi. And what is Fi to the pi? Is the set I to the pi I plus 1 to the pi and so forth, image of these numbers under pi. So I'm just relabeling these numbers. Is first question, is it clear what I'm doing with pi here? Right? I'm taking the numbers and I replace them all systematically according to what pi says. And because I can say instead, I could take this whole thing and act on it with the inverse of pi. Then I have the same f, and I would have the entries of A renumbered, which would keep that intersection condition. And since I didn't use any other property of A, that inequality then would still hold. So I have each of these is bounded by k. So if I sum this up, I get at most k, and for each, and how many summons do I have? I have n factorial summons, because that's the number of permutations. So, okay. So I know this number z is at most k times n factorial. Right.
Now I count another way, so we are using double counting. Namely, what I want to do is let's fix one set in script A and one script in script F. So, fix AJ in script A, FI in script F. And what I want to do is I want to consider permutations. Well, let me, okay, I leave one line free here and I look at permutations pi such that fi to the pi is equal to aj. So how many permutations do I have which would map this specific set fi to this specific set aj? Both are sets of k elements. So I need to map the k elements of fi to the k elements of aj. That gives me k factorial possibilities. So there are k factorial. And then there are n minus k other points which are not in fi, which need to be mapped to make it a permutation. And these I can map to the n minus k points which are not in aj. So I get k factorial times n minus k factorial. There are k factorial times n minus k factorial permutations which will map this fi to this aj. Okay. So, right, and now I want to get a consequence for another way of calculating this Z or Z. Right. So, to have a permit, to get some contribution here, I need to have that pi maps some fi to some aj, right? Then there will be something in this intersection. And how many elements can I have? I claim, therefore, z is equal to m times n times k factorial times n minus k factorial. Okay, so where does this come from? So I'm summing over all permutations, and this is just counting for all permutations. How often can I get some contribution here? When do I get a contribution which involves aj? I get a contribution which involves aj if there is an fi here which under pi is mapped to aj. So, if I'm doing this over all the permutations, I could say, let's first see what is the contribution from A1. Well, it's all the permutations where I have an fi which will map fi to A1. And now let's split it up further. Let's look at the case, let's do the sum, not over the permutations, but let's do the sum over the aj and the fi's. How often can this happen? Well, actually this happens systematically exactly k factorial times n minus k times each time. So the two sums over ai and fj vanish and just become a factor. How many ai's do I have? I have m of them. How many aj's do I have? I have m of them. How many fi's do I have? I have n of them because they can start at any number and then are just a sequence of k subsequent numbers. So I get
m times n times, and that's the number of permutations that I would get a contribution. You want me to go over once more, or? Yeah? Okay. So, I'm summing over the size of these intersections for all permutations. Okay. So, what I'm counting really is how often, if I take all permutations, how often can some fi be mapped to some aj? Right? And I sum this up. Well, it turns out, and I need to sum over all i's and all i's and all j's. Right? Now it turns out, if I fix I and j, it's always the same number. So that sum is a sum over, that will be equal to a sum over I, sum over j, number of permutations such that fi to the pi is aj. That's the sum I want to take. But this I have cancelled. Here is, sorry, this is different point. This count is always the same. That count does not depend on I and j. It's always k factorial times n minus k factorial. So I can take this out, and then I have just n possible i's and m possible j's. And therefore, this is this. Right. So, what can I conclude? It's under the theorem here. That m times n times k factorial times n minus k factorial is smaller or equal than k times n factorial. Right. So, and now we just do some. So this k cancels with a k factorial to a k minus 1 factorial. Right? That n factorial cancels with that n to an n minus 1 factorial. And now I'm bringing down all but m. So I can conclude that m is smaller or equal than n minus 1 factorial divided by k minus 1 factorial times n minus k factorial. And n minus k factorial I can write as n minus 1 minus k minus 1 factorial. And that is just n minus 1 choose k minus 1, which is exactly the claim of the theorem. So, if I have sets in there of a fixed size, subsets of some larger set, and I want that they're not too large, I want that the size is at most half, and I want that they intersect non-trivially, then I can bound. Have we used this anywhere? That k is smaller or equal than n factorial. Don't think we've used this, right? That's the size of the sets, or did we? Oh, we've used. Okay, no, I think we've used this implicitly here, that we don't have to deal with some awkward overlap, that something can't, that the sets can't overlap twice. That's where it implicitly comes in. If, right, otherwise you could have a set which is still overlapping, goes around, and is already starting to overlap again, if they're too large. And then I could have more here and would need to be more careful. So that's where this k smaller or equal than n over 2 goes in. Yeah, and then the total number of sets for which I can do this is bounded. This, as usual with estimates, the question is this bound sharp? Yes, it is. We'll have a homework problem to show that this bound is achieved. And that's not hard. That's not hard to see. Basically, if you look at what is n minus 1 choose k minus 1, well, this is somehow choosing elements one less, so you want to look at an intersection of size 1.
I mean, you could envision building this thing just for every pair ij, specify one element that they have in common, and keep going until you fill up one of the sets.
That's another way of doing it, yes. Yeah, and that is this theorem. We will have some homework problems which use this just to get practice with it in terms of the applications of these theorems are getting a little bit technical. This is basically, this helps you in certain situations that something can't be too wild, that you can't have too many things of different kind. So for example, one situations where these theorems are used are in complexity analysis of algorithms, which in some way bound that if you have input, the input, there can't be too much input or too many objects you need to run through if you want to try out all the possibilities. Yeah, so that's the Erdős-Corrado theorem. We had this sequence of theorems as consequence of Dilworth's theorem, and in a few weeks we will look at some other consequences from that theorem which are more graph theoretical in nature. And we could have done this here, but at some point, if you have multiple topics, you need to decide in which order you do them. And I wanted to deal with post sets and lattices first. So that's why we are doing another topic first, which is about incident algebras and Möbius functions. And don't be scared by the term word algebra in there. This is just to give it a name, to give a name to some kind of structure. So,
are Möbius functions at all related to Möbius transformations or no? Other than by name?
I think only by name, and I think it's not even the same Möbius.
Really?
So, there is, I thought there are multiple ones, but I would need to look up, because I think the Möbius transformations are named after someone in the 1800s, and there is the Möbius strip, and I think the number theoretic Möbius function, which is named after someone from the 16 or 1700s, and it's quite possible that they're related. There weren't that many people on the earth at that time.
The guy from Möbius functions is August Ferdinand Möbius, apparently from 1790 to 1868. I haven't found the person for Möbius transformations yet. Anyway, I was just curious.
Okay, but I might. That's what I have in the back of my mind. But I might be wrong, and I'm sure Wikipedia, at least after you edit it, will correct me. So you will have heard the name Möbius probably before. Well, depending what you did Möbius transformation, that's already a little bit more esoteric. You will probably have heard Möbius strip. And you will have likely seen a Möbius function in number theory. Well, you might not in computer science, but if you did math, right? That's minus 1 to the number of prime factors if a number is square-free, and it's 0 if a square divides the number. And if you haven't seen it, don't panic. We don't need this. It's just at some point, that's where the name comes from. But let me probably start by first actually giving this name. So this is paragraph 5. Incidence algebras and Möbius functions. Right. So what the number theoretic Möbius function does is it is used in some process which then is called Möbius inversion, where we basically have one number theoretic function which is the sum of another function, and one can thereby express the other function in terms of the first. So a typical example there is that if we have the formula the sum over d divides n phi of d is equal to n, can you use this to get a formula for phi of d? And you can in terms of this Möbius function. So what does this mean? Now I'm probably, this is always good to try this without having written it down carefully. So this means phi of n is the sum over d divides n mu of n divided by d. And what is this? This is equal to two cases. It's minus 1 to the a if n divided by d is equal to p1 up to pa, and it's 0 if p square divides n divided by d for some prime p. Well, and it's 1 if n over d is 1. But that basically, that falls into this case. Yeah. So, you might have seen that. If not, don't worry. You'll see it in another framework. And what we are generalizing is basically this idea. We are summing up here over the divisors. So these would be elements in a lattice, right? The divisors form a lattice. We are summing up certain values over entries in a lattice which are below. If we know the sums, can we get the original values back? And this is a little bit like inclusion-exclusion. Right? It's not just the sum, it's the sizes of the intersections, but we have the lattice of subsets, and depending how these hang together, how do we need to weight them to get the total sum? And there we have also coefficients plus minus 1. Basically, these coefficients plus minus 1 would be values of an appropriate Möbius function. So that's the goal where I'm aiming for. And we will get there after doing something which initially might look a little bit weird, unless you allow for the fact that mathematicians, if they have objects, basically the first thing they do with it, they consider functions on these objects. That is really one of our core skills. So, if we have a set, we want to look at functions on a set. And I want to apply this for posets. So, definition, P is a poset. An interval, is it on P? Yeah, on P, not in P. An interval on P is
a set xy, which is the set of those z in P that x is smaller or equal than z, z smaller or equal than y.
So I give two endpoints and I say everything between, including the endpoints. That's what I will call an interval.
And int of P is just the set of all intervals.
And now, as I said, we have a set, we can consider functions on a set. So if we have a field K, and again, yes, you can define it for a field, but if you assume without loss of generality that K is just the rational numbers, you're not missing anything. We can look at I for incidence of P, and yes, this would be the incidence for P with respect to this field K. It's the set of all functions F from the intervals of P to K. So I take the intervals and I take functions on these intervals. Right. So that's just a set of functions.
It becomes an algebra because we can multiply, add, and do all of the other things with functions? Or
but I need to tell you how.
Oh, in the obvious way.
Okay, you want to show what the multiplication is?
That's all you, I'm just asking. Is there?
Yeah.
Is it there?
Yeah, it is.
How do you add two functions on different intervals? Well, we can add their values in K. Yeah, but they're not maps on the same, from the same.
No, they're maps on the same set. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Right? They're functions. So,
so
this is called, well, let's first say, is called the incidence algebra. Okay, so what is, well, incidence, I will tell in a moment where this comes from. Oh, and there again, I have the same sentence twice. I think we had the same mistake before at some point. Yeah.
Is it at the end of one page and then again?
No. It's at the top of the page, but I don't think I can claim that this was.
Maybe you were editing stuff above.
It's just very.
Yes, that is clearly happening, and I'm not very careful in proofreading, but don't tell this to my graduate students. Okay. So I look at this set of functions. So, algebra. What is an algebra? Is in abstract algebra, an algebra is a type of a structure. It is a structure which is at the same time a ring and a vector space, such that the addition is the same, and that the scalar multiplication behaves nicely with the ring multiplication. Well, if that sounds like gobbledygook, it's something like matrices, right? You can add matrices, you can multiply matrices, and you can scalar multiply matrices, and that all plays together nicely. If you have something like that, then it is called an algebra, to give it a fancy name. And we don't really need much here. We don't really need the algebra property, it's just that's part of the name, and yeah. Okay, so on this set, I now want to define addition, scalar multiplication, and multiplication. So these are functions on a set into a field. Well, if you have functions on a set into some kind of structure, as long as you don't go about inversion, the properties of the destination structure are inherited by the functions. If you have functions in a group, well, sorry, group you have, but if you have functions into a set with an addition, you get an addition on the objects. If you have a scalar multiplication on K, so I consider K as a one-dimensional vector space over itself, this set of functions automatically gets the vector space structure. So, then I of P is a K vector space under pointwise operations. And that is just standard abstraction gobbledygook. If you have functions into a vector space, they are always, these functions form a vector space. I could say I have a multiplication on K and could take that multiplication, but I don't want to take this. And that's why I was asking you, is it the obvious multiplication? So it's not the obvious multiplication. So I also define a multiplication. A multiplication on IP. How am I going to do this? I need to define the product of two functions. So let F and G be functions in IP. So I want to define a product F times G. Right? How can I define this product should again lie in IP? So it needs to be a function. How can I describe a function? Basically by describing the values it will have. So I will just say this function F times G, what does it do on the interval between from X to Y? Okay. And what I'm doing here is that shall be the sum over X is smaller or equal than Z is smaller or equal than Y, F of X, Z, G of Z, Y. Okay. So I want to take that multiplication. It looks a little bit like matrix multiplication, and that is very deliberate so. And that's the reason why you could call it the natural multiplication. So, what I claim, and I'm not going to prove this here, I don't know whether I'll put it in the homework exercises or not. One can show that indeed with that multiplication and the vector space addition and vector space scalar multiplication, this set is a K-algebra. But we don't really need that property later on. What I just claim, and there is no particular value in proving this, is that this multiplication behaves nicely with a pointwise addition in terms of distributive law and so on. I can do the usual operations we would like to do. It's not just some weird operation. So, okay. Okay. Right. So then I of P becomes a K algebra. And I claim this K algebra is not just, it's really an algebra with an R in, it's the I in ring. No, I don't have an I there. Anyhow, it's an algebra with one. Any idea what the one element would be? Well, I mean, you can look in the notes and find it. But what would we need to have for the one element? We would need to have, we want this to be equal to f of x, y, right? So, if g is the one element, we would need to have that this is equal to f of x, y, so we only want the summand if z is equal to y. We want a 1 then and a 0 otherwise. So what we get is a function, what we would need is a function which on an interval tests whether both ends of the interval are the same. And something like that, at least physicists like to call the delta function something which is just a peak on one point. So with the 1 is delta xy, which is 1 if x is equal to y and 0 otherwise. Yeah.
So you mean by 1, you mean the multiplicative identity by 1?
So with this 1, I mean the 1 element of the field K, the number 1.
But with 1?
Oh, with the one, yes, sorry, with that one, yes. With a multiplicative identity, yes. Yes. And what the reason why I care about a multiplicative identity is that I want to look at multiplicative inverses of functions. Okay, that looks a little bit, what are we doing there? Bit, but basically look at it like a particular kind of matrix inversion. So, so we have these functions on the sets of intervals, and what we're going to do is we have one particular function here already, the one. There is another very natural function which one could define, namely a function which tests whether something is contained, whether an interval is empty or not, whether something is lying below another one. So that is one particular function, we will define such a function which is called zeta function, and we will calculate an inverse of that. And the inverse of that is what is called the Möbius function. So that's where we're headed to. But we need to first look a bit more at this product and what inverses are. Right, that's all I have for today. Thank you very much, and I'll see you on Wednesday. And don't panic about if you haven't seen this structure type thing, don't panic about it. It's not as bad as it might sound.